This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Not for the first time and probably not for the last. Here you go. Follow the money, the Wall Street money and the political money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, November the 7th. Good to have you along, everybody. With the caveat that Wall Street is a fickle, fickle beast, I'm obliged to point out as we get going, the traders seem to have voted a day early. With the news from FBI Director James Comey yesterday that there was nothing to see after all in those additional emails, and with reports of early voting seeming to favor Hillary Clinton, all three major indices broke that nine-day losing streak they took into the weekend, and they broke it with extreme prejudice gains of 2% or more across the board. Even though the political campaign is going to be over tomorrow, the money campaign does continue, those last-minute fundraising appeals that are flooding many an inbox and Facebook feeds. It is not, given the clock, like those donations are going to be spent by Election Day. So where is that money going to go? From our bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman starts us off.
An email from the Trump campaign today says the candidate's gaining in key battleground states and asks for as little as $5. An email from the Clinton campaign asks supporters to chip in even just a single dollar to support her race to the finish. And will that money help elect Trump or Clinton tomorrow?
Not in the amount of time that it would take to spend it in terms of making any major difference in the election.
Political scientist Bert Johnson at Middlebury College says these appeals are more about political fights to come.
Building your network by encouraging donations, getting names, getting people on lists.
Richard Brifalt, an expert on campaign finance at Columbia Law School, says raising money may be the least important part of asking at this stage of the campaign.
There's also some evidence that it just continues to energize people. I mean, people can participate by voting, by wearing buttons, by making phone calls and giving money.
And money raised now will help pay off debts the candidates are racking up in the last weeks of the campaign, says political scientist Andra Gillespie at Emory University. For legal battles over voting, or
unforeseen expenses tomorrow. Let's say you need to rent another van in order to get people out to the polls.
Leftover campaign funds can also be passed along to other party committees and candidates. But Bert Johnson says mostly campaigns try to spend down their balances.
If you end the campaign with a lot of money in the bank, you're doing it wrong, especially if you're on the losing side. So you could have spent more and perhaps done a little bit better, but didn't.
Which, he says, is one reason campaigns actually try to finish the race in debt. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
About some of those early voting numbers I mentioned, Latinos are one of the fastest growing sectors of the American electorate, especially in some of the battleground states. But if you pay too much attention to national polls, you might not have a sense of who the Latino population is voting for or whether they're even voting at all. Marketplace's Andy Euler reports that making those national polls accurate is not only costly, but also culturally difficult to get right.
At this point in November, you've seen a million polls. Who's voting for each candidate, often broken down into income, gender, race. But look carefully at those race columns, and you might notice that instead of percentages in the Latino column, you get NA, not applicable, like the Nevada poll CNN put out last week. Michael McDonald is an associate professor of political science at the University of Florida. He says there are a couple of reasons the numbers we get in polls about Latinos could be inaccurate.
A pollster may be conducting their interviews in English only.
If Spanish is the language of the household, the voter isn't likely to respond to the survey. Another issue is that the Latino population skews younger, while most polls focus on landlines.
If a pollster is not supplementing their polls with a cell phone sample, then they will be missing a greater number of Hispanic voters as well.
Gary Segura founded the polling firm Latino Decisions 8 years ago to get at exactly this problem. And he thought by now he'd have a lot of competition. He was wrong.
Everyone has the capacity to do this. And if they read any of the academic literature on it, they certainly know it has to be done. But that doesn't mean they're going to do it.
He says hiring bilingual callers is a bit more expensive, but provides more accurate data. And he says most major media outlets aren't ignoring the Latino population on purpose.
They're just taking shortcuts.
Regardless of what the political polls say, Latinos are voting. Numbers from Florida and Nevada show as many Latinos have voted early as did at all 4 years ago. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
All right, enough politics for now. How about some escapism, The latest Marvel superhero adventure, Doctor Strange, dominated the box office this weekend. Benedict Cumberbatch and, frankly, whoever else was in that movie, did $85 million here in the States. Worldwide haul is now $325 million so far. Amazing, really, considering Doctor Strange is, we have to be honest, one of the lesser-known characters in that Marvel universe. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports on how important Marvel is to its parent company, Disney, and how rivals are trying to steal from that playbook.
Vijay Govindarajan read comic books growing up, but when he heard about the latest Marvel movie, it didn't ring bells.
No, I was not familiar with Doctor Strange. This is the beauty of it.
That is the Dartmouth business professor side of him talking, admiring a giant deal that proved all the skeptics wrong.
When Disney acquired Marvel for $4 billion, people thought there was a bad move. People thought there's nothing left in Marvel, no juice left in Marvel.
That's because Disney's deal didn't include well-known characters like X-Men and Spider-Man. Paul DeGarabedian follows box office returns for ComScore and says Marvel has defied expectations.
Even when they go to their bench, if they go to their kind of their art house titles, which are the more esoteric, lesser-known characters, they still manage to do incredible business.
Since 2012, parent company Disney made about $8.3 billion on Marvel movies. Key to the formula has been using its popular characters to promote obscure ones, like in the recent Captain America movie. Jason Squire is a film business professor at USC.
Count the heroes who were on that screen in two types, the ones who were known and introducing brand new characters, Black Panther, for example, as a launching pad.
Marvel's success has rivals like Warner Brothers taking notice, which is now building similar character crossovers into its DC Comics movies. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today, I personally am going to guess the really happy music, but I don't get to pick. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A story now about the start of a series about climate change, grounded not in the idea of whether it's happening because reality, but grounded rather in the idea that people are going to have to change their lives because the planet is getting warmer. To start us off, a story just in time for the election. At the national level, climate change has been ignored. Not a single question about it, for instance, in any of the presidential debates. Local politics is another thing entirely. Cities and states are talking lots about how to deal with it. In fact, this year, San Francisco area voters took a major step in adapting to sea level rise. Marketplace's Jed Kim tells us more.
Last June, voters across 9 counties in the Bay Area approved a tax increase. Measure AA, a $1 a month parcel tax that'll raise $500 million over 20 years. The purpose? Restoring wetlands. It needed 66% of votes to pass. It got 70. David Lewis is executive director of Save the Bay, which spearheaded the funding effort. He says part of the reason it got so much of the vote was there's so much love for the Bay.
When you say San Francisco Bay, you're saying the Bay Area. and Measure AA, which is a very small tax shared by a lot of people to raise a lot of money together for a big benefit, that felt like doing something for the place we live.
Wetlands clean water, provide habitat for animals, and store carbon. But more than that, they're a protection mechanism.
The business community here has come to realize that part of the solution for addressing climate change and adapting to sea level rise in the Bay Area is restoring wetlands where we can do that.
Estimates for the Bay Area put the financial costs of higher sea levels at tens of billions of dollars by century's end. Spots on the 101 freeway right by the bay see more than 100,000 vehicles each day. At Google's headquarters, some buildings lie within 1,000 feet of the shore. And people keep building on the bayfront. Restoring wetlands is a strategy to adapt to what's coming. Higher sea levels, more flooding. What does this kind of adaptation look like? San Mateo County Supervisor Dave Pine recently took me on a tour.
So right now we're looking at one of the most recently completed restoration projects. This is called the Bear Island Project.
That's B-A-I-R, Bear. Up until recently, this was a salt pond, one of many around the bay. Now, after restoration, it's nice in a marshy kind of way. Lots of birds, trail signs talk about the comeback of the leopard shark.
As the bay ecosystem improves and more species are coming back.
The projects are as important for animals, Pine says, as for the humans whose housing is being built right next door.
Tidal wetlands provide natural flood protection for the bay shore. So by restoring these wetlands, we can help protect communities from storm events and from sea level rise, which is a reality we have to face.
The goal, if they can get the money, is to restore 100,000 acres of wetlands to keep the bay's ecology healthy and to put a natural buffer between the ocean and development. David Lewis of Save the Bay says it won't be cheap.
Maybe $2 billion to get from where we are now.
The plan is to leverage AA's $500 million to get federal and state grants. Depending on how things go from here, other areas could follow. Allison Colden is with Restore America's Estuaries.
Now that there is an example of this out there that was successful, I think that there are other candidate areas throughout the country, be it Chesapeake Bay, Galveston Bay, Tampa Bay. There would be the opportunity for others to sort of emulate this.
Emulating means recognizing the strategy. AA was in the works for 13 years, a lot of time to build support among the Bay's counties and cities, community groups, and businesses. David Lewis of Save the Bay says it was also about picking the right time to strike, like waiting till after the recession. Also, picking the right election.
One of the smart choices was to put this on the June ballot when there wasn't a lot of competition for people's attention.
Christina Hill teaches landscape architecture and environmental planning at UC Berkeley.
Who else is going to pay for it? The federal government only bails us out when we have a disaster. So if we're talking about adaptation rather than resilience to a disaster event, we have to figure out how to use our tax bases to pay for these things.
She says similar ballot measures will pretty much be a must for major adaptation projects to happen elsewhere. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
We've tried real hard this whole election cycle to punctuate the never-ending stream of politics and politicians with doses of you and how you're feeling about things as you try to get by. It's a series we call My Economy. Today's dispatch comes to us from Plainfield, Illinois.
We had a goal as a family to visit all 50 states by the time our younger daughter graduated high school. We're at 39 states. My name's Nora Parkman. I'm a home daycare provider, and I've been doing this for 16 and a half years. The thing about home daycare is that my economy depends on the economy of six other families. If a family has a job loss, I have an income loss. And now that the economy's better, they have jobs, but they're trying everything they can to not use daycare. They're using part-time. They're alternating schedules, whatever they can do to not have to have their kids in full-time daycare. I have always told my children that I didn't care what career they had. It was that I wanted them to be the best at whatever career they chose. Home daycare isn't a glamorous job, but it's what I was meant to do. I'm an expert at it. I am the best. But it's more than that now. And I can't just tell my children to go with their heart. They have to also go where the money is. My one daughter wants to become a doctor, which would be good money, and I'm hoping for that for her. She's smart enough to do it. If she gets into college and we pay for college.
Nora Parkman, we got her in Plainfield, Illinois. Take a second and tell us how the economy feels to you. There's a place you can do that at marketplace.org. Coming up.
We would count to five like this. Yan, tan, tether, mether, pip.
Yeah, right. Counting sheep in the north of England. But first, let's do the numbers. There you go. The Dow up 371 points, 2%, 18,259. The NASDAQ up 119 points, 2 and a 3rd percent, 5166. The S&P 500 up 46 points, 2.2%, 21 and a 31 there. The peer-to-peer finance firm LendingClub boosted 15 and 2/10% today as its third quarter results showed smaller than expected losses. Think about that for a second. Other financials moved up as well. Bank of America, 2.75% to the good. Citigroup, Brighton, 3.4%. Digital storage company Seagate Technology and Western Digital counted gains. Seagate bobbed up 5%. Western pointed 4.8% higher today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.82%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million-dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There was a report out last year from the Arizona Department of Education saying that that state's teacher shortage was becoming a crisis. Young teachers and would-be teachers are staying away, and veteran teachers are leaving. It's relevant here to point out that Arizona teacher salaries are well below salaries right next door in California or Nevada, which means the question then becomes, what is a local school district to do when it desperately needs teachers but has no extra money in the budget to throw at the problem? From KJZZ, Kara Young reports.
Thatcher, Arizona is 3 hours east of Phoenix. Most people in this tiny rural town make their living farming or mining, so it's not unusual to see a tractor driving down the road. The town is facing a severe teacher shortage.
We certainly need math and science. The vocational courses, those are getting harder and harder to fill, too.
Carol McAtee is the principal at Thatcher High School. She says finding and keeping good teachers is a challenge, especially in rural Arizona, for a lot of reasons. But McAtee explains much of it boils down to one really glaring issue.
Our salaries are certainly less than what teachers can get in the Phoenix-Tucson area. And of course, if you compare to other states, Arizona is at the bottom.
The low teacher pay is one reason Arizona schools are trying to fill an estimated 2,000 open teacher positions this year. A lot of teachers here get poached by neighboring states like Nevada, where salaries are more than $6,000 higher. McAtee wishes she could match those numbers, but her budget is already stretched to the max, a scenario most state public schools face because state funding isn't keeping up with rising costs.
I'm going to give you an in-class assignment, and it is short.
But officials in Thatcher are hopeful a new teacher training program will offer some relief. Aubrey Larson, teaching this class of ninth graders, is with a program known as iTeach.
Fourth hour, our class average was 86.5. What is average again?
Arizona State University has been opening satellite four-year teaching degree programs in rural community colleges. The goal is to attract students who can't fit a three-hour drive to the closest university into their schedules. The logic? If you're from a rural town, you probably have deep roots there, and you're more likely to want to stay, which is the case for Larson.
My husband's a cotton farmer, so he farms here, and both of our families are here. So there's no plans of leaving. We love it here.
Down the road a bit, officials in Casa Grande are working with a more international solution. After striking out at job fairs both in and out of Arizona, Superintendent Shannon Goodsell says he was forced to look outside the country to fill jobs. He now brings in certified teachers from the Philippines.
Finding a special education teacher is hard enough. Finding a special education teacher who would like to accept the low salaries that are offered in the state of Arizona is even worse.
While Arizona's teacher salaries are low, they are at least five times higher than the Philippines. Lily Viglimbaga is one of the 14 Filipino teachers now working in Casa Grande.
The sum of money is good if you're going to compare or convert that to our Philippine peso money. But then it's a secondary because our main purpose is to grow professionally.
But while these two schools have found a way to get certified teachers into classrooms, Justin Wang, the president of the Arizona School Personnel Administrators Association, says with such a shortage, most are resorting to things like larger class sizes and long-term subs.
Individuals with no experience teaching, most if not all have degrees, of course, but it may be in a different field.
On the flip side, if you actually want to become a teacher here, you're pretty much guaranteed a job. In Thatcher, Arizona, I'm Carrie Young for Marketplace.
This has been a rough election season, we know that, so bear with us here while we detour to the very north of England, just almost up to Scotland, to talk about sheep and a slice of rural life and work that not many of us get to experience. James Rebanks is a shepherd in the Lake District of England, doing a job that his family has been in for generations. His new book about that life and that job is called The Shepherd's View. Mr. Rebanks, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
You basically took over a family-owned business, right? Your dad was a shepherd? I mean...
My grandfather and everybody all the way back as far as we can find for a sort of 600 years plus. We just ran out of paperwork. We didn't run out of shepherds.
How is business? I mean, you said before we turned the mic on, you have 900-something sheep. I mean, how do you get by? You doing all right?
In terms of farming, we struggle. Like all traditional farmers all around the world, we're under intense pressure at the moment. And have been for a long time, actually. So the sheep we sell, the breeding sheep we sell, are about a quarter of the real price they were 40 years ago when I was born, when I was a kid. And what we produce is still considered too expensive because industrial factory farm chicken is about 10 or 12 times cheaper than it was when I was a kid. So the ratio has gone in the wrong direction for it. So the challenge for us and the challenge for sort of traditional small farmers all around the world, heritage breeds and heritage farmers, is to try and find a way to keep that going.
What kinds of sheep do you raise, by the way? I know I should know this, but I don't.
We keep a breed of sheep called Herdwicks, which are the sort of native sheep of that landscape, and their DNA goes straight back to Viking sheep. We think they came at least 1,000 years ago with the Vikings, or at least some of them did, and the nearest relatives are on the islands that the Vikings came from, And actually, our dialect comes from, I'm not speaking in my dialect now, I'm trying to speak in the Queen's English, but our dialect comes from the same places.
I would ask you to speak your dialect, but I probably wouldn't understand it, right?
Well, we have our own system of counting, so we would count to five like this: yan, tan, tethra, medra, pip. And
wow.
many of the words I use for my working life are understood better in Norway, and I've tested this, it's true. They're better understood in Norway and Sweden than they are in London.
Do you sell the wool or do you sell the sheep? Or I guess you sell both, right? You got to make a living.
Well, actually, we do both of those things. We sell wool, although I've got to tell you that it costs three times as much to get it off the sheep as it's worth, so we don't farm for wool anymore. Our spare male lambs go for meat. So Herdwick mutton and lamb is probably the best sheep meat in the world. It was eaten at the Queen's coronation. But actually, there's a third category.
But that was a while ago. I mean, 1952
was a while ago. It was the best then, and trust me, it's still the best sheep meat in the world. But there's actually a third category. The mountains, historically the mountains in England, were the nursery for the sheep flock for the whole of the UK. That's actually what I make most of my money selling, breeding sheep from the mountains that go on to live in the lowlands.
One of the great things about this book, the new one, The Shepherd's View, is the pictures that are in it. And I say that as a way to get into the fact that you are big on Twitter and Instagram. And I love the idea of this guy coming down from the mountains of north of England and putting pictures of his rural life out into social media.
We can't let Kim Kardashian and these people have it all the wrong way, can we? I think we've got to fight back and take back social media for working people and sort of proper things. So I was a little bit skeptical to start off with, but really what I do, I have a Twitter account called @HurdyShepherd1. And what I do on there is I share my day-to-day life. So it's not about me as an individual or some kind of celebrity. It's about my working sheepdogs and my flock of sheep and the sort of working life of the mountains. And yeah, it's crazy. We have 85,000 followers on there. People like the photographs and the commentary about what we're doing. And I think it's good for everybody, both farmers and the general public, to have that dialogue and to be talking to each other. So I try to play my part.
James Rebanks, his newest book is called The Shepherd's View. It's a follow-up to The Shepherd's Life from a couple of years ago. Mr. Rebanks, thanks very much. I enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
We've got some of his photos on our website, marketplace.org. He, by the way, is at @HurdyShepherd1 on Twitter and Instagram. You can get me, should you so choose, @KyRisdahl. Final note on the way out today, Merriam-Webster, the dictionary people, updated their Twitter header today in honor of the election. They said the image is the word Götterdämmerung, noun, a collapse as of a society or regime marked by catastrophic violence and disorder. I personally, I'm going to say that's a little pessimistic. Traders, as I said at the beginning, voted with their wallets. The Dow up 371 today, 2%. The Nasdaq up 119 points, 2.33%. The S&P 500 up 46 points, 2.2%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder, Robert Garoba, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizal. We are back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.